by way of introducing this subject of worship and its meaning for us. You know, most of the time here we talk about universal worship. We are primarily Advaitically oriented. We like to feel that everyone is an embodiment of the divine, and we talk about the universe and the environment and all of that as being shadows and veils over the reality. We talk about finding the divine reality in and around and amongst us. We chanted this morning a chant, O Great Spirit, Thou art in, you are inside and all around us. And that is what we generally like to feel. We ourselves are somehow that great self, that great being whom we worship, and we enshrine that in our hearts, and we see it all around us and try to see it. Everyone else is the shrine of that kind too. That's the general trend of our thought here, and Swami Vivekananda emphasizes this and makes such a point of it that we often quote him and read him on the subject of universal worship. We're proud of Mother Teresa because she sees Christ in every patient and dying person that she rescued. So that is generally the framework in which the presentations are given here at the Vedanta Center and in most of our centers. Today, though, instead of that very comprehensive outlook which we have taken up as our party line, you might say, that impersonal or universal worship, the worship of the impersonal, the worship of the universal, all-pervading divine being who is inside of us and outside of us and is everywhere available if we would only look for it. Instead of that, today I want to take up the subject of formal ritualistic worship. It's called ritualistic because it's formal. Devotional worship. I'm talking about devotional worship. That kind which you see us doing here on birthday celebrations, as you will next week on Sunday when we have Buddha's birthday. And of course, not only his birthday, it's more than that, but it is his birthday. And on these occasions, at least five times a year, we have special ritualistic formal worship at the shrine with ingredients of offering and with a particular purpose of being devoted to, having devotion to, an emblem, a symbol, a photo, or a picture, or some other kind of representation of something which we consider to be a focal point for our devotion for this occasion. This is made especially significant for us. And I know that this is not the most popular form of Vedanta, and obviously many people absent this morning, but it's something that we need to hear occasionally and especially in preparation for a ceremonial occasion like that. So that's what I want to discuss today. And believe me, if you only knew it, how important this is to me personally and how much it means to me, let me tell you that if I had anyone here to help me, I would be doing this every day, in abbreviated form, of course. But every morning I would be coming to this, our shrine, and making a formal offering of at least five items which are traditional with us. And I would be doing that every day, and I cannot, because I cannot accomplish the work of the center and still do that. I can't get in all my work, my meditation, and everything, and that has to be let go. And there are a number of our centers in this country where that is so, and where it is not possible for the Swami to. There are some where it's not possible for the Swami to do worship every morning. But where it is possible, I assure you that the monk in charge will prefer to do that and will always do that, if he can. So, it's something which obviously enhances life and makes our whole day a different affair for us. Those of us who are devoted to that, we have to acknowledge that this is a devotional exercise. It's done to a personal God. We are conceiving of God here as a personal being. There are many ways in which to do that, which I shall be discussing during this talk. But for us, it is an object of personal, it is an office of personal devotion, just as the divine office is said in a Catholic or a Christian convent or a monastery, in a church or a cathedral. There are the daily offices which are said. And you know, the problem about it is that other people who do not understand this kind of a devotional exercise, a personal devotion, are very critical of it. I know that many of the Indian people themselves, the people from India who know about this kind of function and what it means, are very critical and skeptical of it, because they have seen so many cases of it being done in a perfunctory way. Anything that you do over and over tends to become perfunctory unless you infuse it with your own heart's blood, with your own heart's devotion, your own mind's concentration and input. And it's quite natural that people in the world who have busy lives and have little time will cut back and cut back and ultimately probably make a mere pass at conducting a daily office. It's not excusable in monasteries and convents, and we hope that in ashramas and such places that the atmosphere and spirit created by such an exercise is maintained because there's no excuse not to do it. But in the lives of busy people, one can understand why this is not done. So a lot of people have come because of seeing the hypocrisy of priests, people who are appointed to be priests or hired to be priests. They go through the motions of this kind of an operation, this ritual, or this office with very little feeling. You might find them one moment offering something to God, and then the next moment chatting some gossip with people who have come to the temple. And because you see examples like that, you do not understand what other people do not understand what it means to be performing something which is supposed to absorb your whole being, your pranas, your energy, your mind, your concentration. All of the senses are involved in it, and they are made operative with respect to a central, living, personal deity. See, it's very hard to get into that kind of a position. And so there is the reluctance to acknowledge the value of this and to understand it. If this is both an art and a science. Devotional worship is both an art and a science. I think the artistic part of it will be pretty clear to you. It may not be difficult to explain to you why it's considered an art. First of all, if you are going to do anything in the way of music, you have to present it in as perfect a form as you can. You would, mostly, of course, in India, the musicians memorize the music, the words and the music. They never refer to a score. But that's not our custom in the West. But when one goes to a shrine or a church to perform any kind of offering in the way of a piece of art, whether it is something you've made, or something you're going to say, or something you're going to sing, or whatever it may be, or a poem that you want to recite, you go with the best offering that you can make. This is taken for granted. It's an art because if you watch it and see it performed by an expert performer of puja, you will see that in that execution of that for office, execution of that ceremony, there is a great deal of artistry. There is skill. There is a definite awareness of how not to be clumsy, how not to waste, how not to. One of our swamis was criticized in India. Long ago, this story is told, but long ago, one of our earliest swamis was criticized by one of the great disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. He said, "You used 2 matches to light that candle. Why? Why did you need a second match? You didn't light the first one carefully." That's the kind of thing that I'm talking about. It's all very well and good for us to say, "Oh Lord, thou art the soul of our souls, and every action of ours is an offering unto thee, and all our desires may be all my invocation this morning was aimed at what we call Shankara's idea." It was Shankara wrote that hymn. Universal worship. Worship of God in and through everything. And that all sounds so good, and it sounds so wonderful, and it doesn't bind you to any kind of theism. And you think, "Oh, well, that's great." But you see, if every act is his adoration, how important it is that he be adored, or she be adored, through every act that we do, whether it's lighting a match, or whatever it may be, running a country, or anything else. So that's the art of puja. The science of puja may not be so obvious. The science of puja is more difficult to appreciate. Because it's not a physical science, it's not a science of hard objects or of theorems or of tables of elements or anything like that. But it's a science in the sense that it demands that the pursuer or the performer draw up from within himself all of the resources, energy-wise and attention-wise, concentration-wise. It takes, absorbs energy from lower parts of the body and transmutes them, sublimes them to places, parts of the body which are higher. The noise and distraction of the world, even that world which is immediately around, the worshipper is supposed to be shut out. He starts by closing off the senses so that they don't interfere, they don't come interrupt him. There's a lot of science involved in it, and that's an esoteric science. It's a science which has to be explained and understood by those who study it and practice it. I cannot easily make it clear to you how this is a science, because it is not obvious. But That is the fact. Is there a difference between an art and a science? I'm not sure that there is a difference between science and art. If we really go deeply into art, we find how scientific it can become to make something in the proper proportions for aesthetic appreciation. And you discover by various scientific experiments that there are certain relationships, ratios of one thing to another, which make them artistic. And there are certain vibrations which are more pleasing to the ear than other vibrations, and so on. Science and art are closely interwoven. And the more deeply you go into spiritual life, and when you get to science or an art of puja, it becomes very clear, especially to the one who is doing it, if not to those who are witnessing it. Well, where does this ritual worship come in the hierarchy of spiritual practices? That's a good question to bring up. Sri Ramakrishna puts it clearly for us, and yet he hasn't said the whole word on it either. First comes external worship. That's the first in the series. Then comes japa, or prayer. Then comes prayer. First comes external worship. Anybody can do that if they're taught. Then comes prayer, which is more difficult because you don't really know how to pray. We don't. Then comes japa. The repetition of the name of God is higher than prayer, more difficult, with only a little formula. You are supposed to deepen your consciousness and alter and transform your life just with a little formula. And then next above japa is meditation. And meditation is also very much more difficult than japa. You have to silence everything, bring up a concentrated image, and hold it in your mind, and deepen your consciousness and your concentration until you become one with that. And finally, there is ecstasy. Ecstasy is, of course, the fruit, but also the practice of all that's gone before. And after ecstasy comes union, divine union, samadhi, nirvana, whatever you want to call it. But you know, though Sri Ramakrishna gives us this hierarchy, he has left out one very simple fact. Only after meditation, can proper and true devotional worship be done. Only after you have really got a concentrated mind, a mind which is able to meditate, which can visualize this entity that we're going to worship, only after that does formal worship become really meaningful. The beginning part of formal worship may be all well and fine as a kindergarten, but that worship does not become a science or an art or a true spiritual practice until after we have learned to meditate. And if you see priests or other performers of ritual who are not deeply engrossed, who are not caught up in the act of worship, very likely the reason is that they have never really learned to meditate. So that is the way I see it, that intermediate step there. Worship itself may be a beginning, but it is not come to fruition until after we have learned to do meditation. Well, I think it's difficult in this country, in this Protestant culture, which is primarily a Protestant culture, to explain this question, this subject, to to people. I find myself in difficulty with it much of the time, with Roman Catholics or Greek Orthodox. I have a friend who is Lebanese. She is Greek Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, actually. No problem at all. No problem at all in understanding what ritual is all about, why we do the things we do in worship. No problem. They may find that their own priests are not up to the mark, but they don't see any problem about the process. So, in the Protestant culture and in the Bible Belt, as it's called here, there are very good reasons why people shy away from and are not comfortable with formal worship. But just see, in almost every religion in the world, these practices are done. Even in early Buddhism, except perhaps in the very earliest form of period of Buddhism, when there were no images, and everyone was picking up on the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and that doctrine and that those sutras were being circulated gradually with time in every country to which Buddhism went. Rituals began to accumulate, and images were built, and shrines were made, and pagodas were set up, and stupas were erected, and worship and rituals were done. It's part of human nature. It's part of our human nature to want to devote our senses and our aesthetic feelings to a higher object in our life. One may not be able to explain what it is that makes one do this, but there is an urge to it in every country. Take up the Chinese religions. Of course, they have Taoism, and Taoism very quickly became cult-like and became ritual. And in Buddhism in China, then if you come to Islam, the same respect, the same kind of ritualistic observance is made with respect to the Kaaba that is made in our faiths to a shrine, or in Judaism to the scrolls. I went in London to a celebration, a Jewish celebration, interfaith celebration. It was held in the synagogue, and in that synagogue there was an elaborate ritual procession, most careful and devoted reverential sequence of procedures which brought out the scrolls and reverenced them and sent them back in. This is found in all these religions, especially, of course, in Hinduism. Every sect of Hinduism has its temples and its shrines and its worship procedures. And that is just something that we cannot avoid. It's in our nature. Even if you think that you are a great rationalist and you have no respect or consideration for the practices connected to a personal God, you may find that you'll be surprised if you set aside a few prejudices and begin to try to understand or relate to what these people are doing. So I think belittling, we don't belittle. Don't belittle anybody's worship, any form of worship that has caught somebody's imagination and heart and mind. The next question comes up. Isn't it mere projection? When we go to the shrine and we conceive that Sri Ramakrishna or whoever it is for the day is dwelling in that image or in that place, on that altar, are we not just simply projecting an imaginative thing? Well, I'd say here, be careful. Be careful about that. Now, unless you practice this, unless you have practiced this and understood it and been trained in it, it may seem like that. If you have practiced in it, if you have done it at all under any kind of guidance, you will know that that is not at all the case. You see, when I go there to begin the worship, I have to meditate first and conceive, let's say, this is since Buddha is coming up, I have to install in my heart and mind first an image or picture of my conception of Buddha. I will see him there as I would like to see him. Luminous visage, full of wisdom, his hand in a teaching mudra, and his eyes either closed in depth in deep meditation or shining and open and shining. I will do that, and then I will have to transfer that conception to the shrine. I'll have to First of all, I make a resolution. Today, being the sacred day appointed, we have appointed for worshiping Buddha's thrice blessed experience. This being that day, I now resolve to perform externally the worship of Lord Buddha as prescribed by the tradition or the scriptures. And then I transfer this image or picture that I have in my mind to the picture or to the shrine, whatever I'm going to do there. And, you know, when you go to movies or on TV, you have to put yourself into the drama. If you see a play or a movie, and you have to set aside the fact that this is Swami Yogeshananda sitting in the movie theater, and the popcorn is over here, and all of that that goes with the external situation. You've got to lose. You can't be eating popcorn and really enjoying that movie all the time. That's not the way to do it. You have to put yourself into the story. You carry yourself along with the plot. And then only when it's over can you come back and say, oh, yeah, well, I wasn't after all that character. From childhood, I have done that. I don't believe there is really any way to enjoy a drama unless you put yourself into that drama. That's what children do. And you know, children make up playmates. They make up imaginary adventures and go into worlds that we do not know of. And I remember coming back and reporting on things that were just as real to me as the world around me until I was about 7 years old. That's an age when you begin to wake up to what grown-ups call reality. And then the other times you become absorbed in what was real for you, and just as real as breakfast and dinner and coming home on time. So it is not an unimaginable faculty of the human mind that it should be able to recreate a given scene and project that and hold it for the required operation of this performance. And if you do, and you can do this, probably you will feel that you are in a presence Well, I was going to say, forgot to say, you know, at night, what do? You make your own movies at night. You have your own home movies. What do we do at night but to dream a great show of all kinds of extraordinary events, impossibilities, and we don't think them at the time to be impossible. Now, if the human mind has this capacity, has it not got the capacity to create an image, a presence of the divine in a particular form? So, those who go to such occasions, to such observances, have often told me, I have been told by people who have come to these functions, I don't have any faith in ritual. I don't have any faith in the worship. But you know, as I sat there, a presence made itself felt. Something I couldn't describe, something I could never have created myself, overcame me and filled this room and filled my mind and even my heart. And people came not very long ago, and a couple came, and maybe they'll come next week, and they said that same thing. They're not in our movement at all, but they just felt that that's the way it was. Look at this universe. Who's dreaming up this universe? Divine Mother. This is Divine Mother's Leela. This is her dream, her play, her drama. She's doing this whole kit and caboodle every day in every way. This universe and all of its galaxies and innumerable and interminable spaces is being played out in a cosmic mind, which we like to call Divine Mother or God. All right, so I have set the stage, but now there are three more questions. Who or what are we worshiping when we go to this function? I like Rudolf Otto's approach. He wrote a book, The Idea of the Holy. Rudolf Otto was a German philosopher, author. And he calls that which is worshipped by man the holy. There is something within everyone, I hope, if they haven't completely trampled it underfoot. There should be something in everyone which is regarded as the holy, the superior. Even people who have no pretension of faith in religion at all, or spirit, no aspirations to spirituality, will acknowledge the value of some kind of hierarchy, some kind of superior being, even if it's only a human one, is the holy, the respectful, the reverenced. There's a nice little book in the library called Reverence, and that book points out that almost every humanist, every non-believer, everybody, skeptic, has an idea of something to be reverenced, revered. So, and we call it sometimes the other, something other than our little selves, a divine presence. Most of the religions of the world call this object of worship, God, or Father, Mother, so on. Technically, from Vedantic standpoint, what we're worshiping is called Saguna Brahma. Brahman, the ultimate reality, the all-pervading existence, Sat, Chit, Ananda, indescribable except by such terms. When endowed with qualities, qualities of response, of beauty, of charm, of art, of expertise, of all kinds of qualities that you can put on, and purity, goodness, mercy. This is called Brahman with qualities, Saguna Brahman. And that is the object, technically, of our external worship. What do we use for this in calling up this object of external worship? We use what the Hindus call murtis, murti. Murti means a form, a concrete form. A murti is an image, what missionaries like to call idols. Idols. We have images or murtis which are made according to traditional prescriptions, traditions, make up the formulae by which these murtis are made. Someone long ago had a vision of Shiva. Somebody had a vision out of the corporate collective unconscious. This image appeared in the mind. Someone else heard about it, or perhaps that person himself or herself was able to execute a murti, an image of that, what they saw. Sometimes we use geometric things, just a pillar for Shiva, or a triangle for feminine, symbolizing the feminine in us. And then sometimes we use celestial entities, images from the collective subconscious, what Jung would call archetypes, Shiva, Kali, Krishna. These were originally archetypes from the collective unconscious. Or we may use historical figures, like we're going to do next week. Buddha is a known historical figure. So full of knowledge, so full of wisdom. And for us, he becomes something more than human. And so we make him a murti. We take the historical person or character and make of that something worthy of our worship. That's anthropomorphic, yes. You want to call it anthropomorphic. It's an embodiment of something called prajna. Prajna, I should say. Prajna, wisdom. It's an embodiment of wisdom. And now we come to the second question, who is the worshipper? The worshipper is anyone who feels like worshipping. It's not forbidden to anyone in our movement. Of course, in India, we have all of your caste restrictions and all of the gender considerations. Usually it's a man. The worshipper is almost always a man and woman, a man in India, but not always. Holy Mother worshipped every day of her life, every mature life, she worshipped. And many women in our convents are worshipping. We don't have any kind of gender restriction on worship in our movement. And in Hollywood, all of the nuns worship, and many of them worship in their own little shrines every day. So anyone who feels like it, the tradition, of course, is different in India. Our tradition is that anyone can do worship. But, of course, there are ways in which the pujari is chosen. We are chosen in our order by talent. If someone shows a particular talent for that, for instance, I graduated in my brahmachari class, initial class, novice, I'm trying to say, in my novitiate class, I graduated with 17 or 18 other young men, most of them younger than I was, And right away, one or two of them were picked out by the authorities. They were appointed to the shrine. They will do shrine duty. They will go, and from morning till night, they will attend on that image, on that central deity. Where God is considered to be living, God is living in that place, in that shrine. You will go and wake her up in the morning and get her dressed. How, I remember how, at Kanyakumari in the south, when I went to the temple of the Divine Mother, there she's a young princess. The princess is considered embodiment of God. She's a divine princess. She's wakened in the morning, she's wrought, she's bathed, she's dressed, she has her ornaments put on her, all of these things are done. So these two young men were assigned to a shrine right away, while others were sent out to preach, to do library work, to come to America, to go out to distant posts and become purveyors of our message, or to be missionaries to the ill, or clean up a village. All kinds of things are being done. But some go to the shrine to do just this. And they would be people, generally the boys who had been brought up in families where there was priesthood. They might be Brahmins. Usually they would be Brahmins, brought up in the priesthood, and who have a natural bent and understanding of this. To be a worshipper, one should have mantra diksha. One should have the diksha, the initiation with a mantra, in order to, because you're going to have to use your mantra in the performance of the worship. As the performance of the worship goes on, there are places where one has to use one's own mantra with the thing on the fingers and so on. I do that silently, and but there are other mantras that have to be done verbally, or can be done out loud. Like alone can know like. Atman seeks Brahman. What is it in us that seeks to worship? It is the Atman who seeks through this divisive process, this roundabout way, to honor and worship and experience the presence of Brahma. It is so the worshiper is ultimately Atman, seeking through devious ways, as our whole world is devious, to reach that which is the Brahman in the object. And then finally, what is worship? There are two kinds, primarily two kinds of worship. This is the final question, not finally. three questions. What is worship? Sakama worship will be like you see at so many temples, many Hindu temples. Somebody comes with a fruit, somebody comes with a big banknote, somebody comes with a gift of food, and that offering is given to the priest, and the priest goes to the image and rings a bell and waves incense and does this and offers that to the deity, brings it back, and probably gives some other person's fruit as prasad to the worshiper. All the time that that's going on, the person who has come to the temple is saying, oh, may the baby be a boy. Oh, may the baby be a boy. Oh, may I pass this examination. Oh, may I pass this examination. This is called sakama worship. Worship with desires. I cherish in my heart some kind of agenda, some kind of secret motive, hidden desire. And that's what I really want, more than the prasad that comes back from the priest. What is done in our order, all the way through, from beginning to end, is called nishkama karma, or nishkama worship. It is worship which is done without any ulterior motive, without any worldly purpose in mind, not even any heavenly purpose in mind, not like Nachiketa's father, who was offering his cows and all of that for the sake of a heavenly reward. When he died, he wanted to be in a good place. So many in religion, every religion in the world, so many people are performing rituals with such desire. Ours is nishkama. We do not have or cherish any hidden purposes in our worship. We are worshiping purely for the sake of honoring and loving the object before us. That's the only thing that we are doing it for, and for the because that also benefits us. You can say that, yes, there's this desire in it, that I may be able to perform the worship in such a way that I will also feel the benefit from it. That's legitimate desire. That doesn't make it sakama. So, after we offer, and what do we offer in this worship? We offer things that human beings always enjoy and appreciate. Beautiful music, aromas, fine aromas, perfumes, things that we enjoy to smell, things that we know are good to taste, good to eat. We offer items which, some of the items that we offer in our puja, our worship, are universal items. Flowers, food, incense, light, water. These are things universally used everywhere. Other things may be more local. I remember someone who brought chocolates to be offered in San Francisco in the shrine upstairs, and they were told that Sri Ramakrishna had not known chocolate. So please don't bring chocolates for offering to Sri Ramakrishna. Now that's putting a very local interpretation on what you see. Such, that kind of interpretation says, well, I see Sri Ramakrishna as a man of Bengal of 1836. And that's all right. There's nothing wrong with that. But it's narrow. It's narrow. And if that's your conception, fine. Then you bring things which you know Sri Ramakrishna would have liked in 1880. That's all right. You do that. But if you think of Sri Ramakrishna as something, as someone who cannot be confined to a historical bracket, but represents Saguna Brahman, then you can bring anything which you like to offer, which you think would be good to offer, and all that. In this country, you would be different from the things in India. So there are universal offerings, and there are also local offerings. Well, I'm not going to have time to give you all that I wanted to give you, because I can go on this subject for hours. I am very fond of doing worship, and as I say, I did it for 2 years straight in Ganges, Michigan, in an empty hall, a hall that would hold 400 people, all alone. 2 hours I performed the worship in that shrine for 2 years or more. Do you think that mattered to me, that there wasn't anybody else there? It didn't matter. God and I, that's it, the relationship. God and I. How do we relate? How can I use these 2 hours to maximize my relationship to God? Well, so now, it's done daily in many of our ashramas and centers. Here, I told you I would be doing it in an abbreviated form. There are elaborate preparations that have to be made for a puja. That shrine, as we call it, has to be cleaned thoroughly, washed, cleaned. The pictures have to be bathed. I have to think of those pictures as living entities, which I am giving like a patient's bath to those beings. I myself have to take a shower, clean myself from head to foot before beginning. All of the items which are to be offered have to be properly prepared. I mustn't offer flowers which have cankers or which have been eaten by an insect. All of those things have to be perfect. I have to make as perfect an offering as I can. When I cook the food, if I'm going to offer food, I'm supposed to cook it without smelling it. Now, that's a trick. Try that sometime. But at least without tasting it, I cook it without tasting it, so I have to know the recipe, I have to know what to prepare, and I use fresh ingredients, and I bring them. Well, I told you about what you do when you sit down. After you sit down, you make a resolution that this is what we're going to do today, and again, you have to purify yourself with water. You take the water and purify yourself and all this way, and say mantras and so on. Then what else? What next? You remove obstructions. I'm going to go through this for you a little bit today so that it makes it easier. Of course, I have that sheet for you to read, but then there are more things in it, more things than are on that sheet. Why do we remove obstructions? Well, this is more or less a cultural thing, because in India from time immemorial it has been thought that there are vindictive and dark forces which can cast spells and who have a habit of doing that to people who are trying to improve themselves. And, there are plenty of forces like that in this country. There are plenty of cultural and media influences which would love to pull you back down from whatever stance you are trying to take spiritually. Every few minutes you're exposed to them. So when we go in there, we say, let my mind, my body, my mind, let the place, let everything be freed from corrupting influences or any obstruction that might prevent this from being a sacred ceremony. And then, before we honor God, we honor our teachers, our gurus, those who have brought us to this understanding, those who have trained us in what we are about to perform, the minor deities which preside over, traditionally preside over the functions of the universe, the gods who run the forces of nature. And we place the divine being from our heart, as I told you, onto the shrine, into the shrine, and make it living there. We try to conceive that this picture which we are looking at, or image or form, has become a living thing, that we are relating to it as a living thing. And then comes the meditation, when the form of the image is kept in mind and we do what is called mental worship. You see, all that you see when you go there to this puja, all that you see is what we do externally. You cannot probably, I hope, maybe, shouldn't hope, but anyway, you probably don't see inside my mind to see how well or what I am doing there with respect to the mental worship. But before that formal worship comes, with the incense and the light and the bell and the food and the music and so on, before all that is given to God, I have to, in my mind, imagine the living entity in front of me, and there I have to create a mood of forgetting all about this outside if I can, and there he and I, or she and I, are there alone, and I offer the traditional ingredients, which are one after another lined out for me, water to wash feet in the dusty country. These things are pretty cultural. Then there's water to drink, just as you go to somebody's house. Would you like some lemonade? Would you like fruit juice? Would you like coffee? Whatever you like. Then, besides that, after that comes water for taking. Would you like to use our bathroom, our shower? It's hard to put it in the Western context, because these are things that are done in India. You offer water for a bath, water for drinking, water for rinsing your mouth. Then you offer a respectful greeting, argya, we call it argya. And then finally you offer clothing and scent for perfume to put on the body if it's a woman, a female deity, and food, and all of this takes place mentally. I have to abbreviate it here. There isn't time to go through all that. You wouldn't have the patience to sit there and wait for me to go through all of it. It has to be abbreviated. But that's what's going on. I am making a mental reality of that which will next become a physical reality, an external reality. So the internal worship goes on. Then comes the external worship. And what is offered, it's a very human kind of worship, in other words. Then at the end, I say, before coming back to the external, I say, may he illumine us. Will you please illumine us? That's what we're here for. We have done this. You said, that's a sakama. No. The Holy Mother has said, pontificated, the desire for God, the desire to realize truth, the desire for emancipation, illumination, is not in the category of desires. We don't call that sakama. You can say, may he illumine me. May I become illumined. May I become freed and gain true freedom through this experience. Well, what happens to other people in the worship? That's for you to say. I cannot, I only know it from my own experience of other people's worshiping. I find myself tremendously affected by worships. I often wish that I could go to the other centers and attend the puja. I can't do it because they have their pujas when we are having our puja. I can't go to the places where other swamis are performing this and take advantage of that, being a visitor, being an attendee. I can't do that. I have to do the thing myself. So those of you who are attending on it, you have to get your kinds of benefits from the experience of witnessing it. And then the external worship proceeds, and you know about that, and the idea of prasad. Here we have taken our best and given it to God, our purest things, and given it to God in the worship. And like the family seniors and elders in the family who pass their plates on to the youngsters, knowing that they will enjoy, that idea that God has left remnants for us, and we take those remnants, and that food purifies us because it has subtly, there are all kinds of subtle things which go on in this process. I can't take time to explain those to you, nor can I really do it, because if you have the psychic talent to perceive how these things are operating, then you know that even the food is changed. This is, of course, the idea behind transubstantiation in the Catholic Church. Even the materials used in the worship have changed endemically, electronically, atomically, by the process of going through this worship. And they are changed thereby. Well, finally, let me finish. Worship is not to be done in a hurry. I have to tell myself this all the time. Is it to be given up in a make-haste culture? I hope not. I hope not. I hope that in a make-haste culture, this habit, this custom will not be given up by our centers, at least. If not, and I wish, of course, that more of you would be able to do it in your own homes. And we come back to the invocation. May our every word be a hymn unto thee. May our every act be thine adoration. Our every step pilgrimage to thy shrine. May we realize, O Lord, that all we see is lighted by thy light. That this is the universal worship. The worship that Shankara wants us to participate in every day of our life. And we can all do that. And not many of us can perform external worship. But we can all do this. And that's what we're expected to do. Any comments, any questions?